But for most historians, they argue that the Native peoples were just overpowered by the strength of the United States, and isn't that a shame, but it wasn't genocide. That it wasn't genocide by plan. They just dropped dead every time a European got near them, you know, they're gone. It wasn't because they were herded into refugee camps without food or water and any kind of medical care or their traditional medicine. But if disease, I've always contemplated this, because there were a lot of diseases, but how do they happen? How's it happening in Syrian refugee camps in Turkey right now, or the Syrian refugee camps in the Afghan refugee camps in Pakistan? Disease spreads like crazy in these, you know, unclean, unhygienic, poor food in those situations. But I say if disease could have done the job, it is not clear why the United States took so much trouble and found it necessary to carry out unrelenting wars against the indigenous communities and nations in order to gain every inch of land they took from them. Along with the prior period of British colonization, nearly 300 years of eliminationist warfare. In the case of the Jewish Holocaust, no one denies that more Jews died of starvation, overwork, and disease under Nazi incarceration than died in gas ovens per se or murdered by other means. Yet the acts of creating and maintaining the conditions that led to those deaths clearly constitute genocide. And of course, genocide was not complete.
You're listening to Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz on genocide and settler colonialism. This is Independent Alternative Radio. You can get copies of this program by calling us at 1-800-444-1977. Again, that's 1-800-444-1977. Or go online, our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org.
Not all of the acts iterated in the Genocide Convention are required to exist to constitute genocide. Any one of them suffices. I'm sure you can find cases in Canada, but here are some cases of the United States genocidal policies and actions under each of the categories, not just the four I talked about. The first, killing members of the group. The Genocide Convention does not specify that large numbers of people must be killed in order to constitute genocide, rather that members of the group are killed because they are members of the group. Assessing a situation in terms of preventing genocide, this kind of killing or conditions that, let's say, in the black community, I think this is very applicable to police brutality as well as mass incarceration. Second, causing serious bodily or mental harm to members of the group, such as starvation, the control of food supply and withholding food as punishment or a reward for compliance, for instance, in signing confiscatory treaties, the use of alcohol, barrels of alcohol being brought to treaty negotiations. As military historian John Grenier points out in his First Way of War, and I do use that, that's an amazing book, he wrote, for the first 200 years of our military heritage, he's a commander in the U.S. Air Force and has a doctorate in history and teaches at the Air Force College. And I was shocked that, of course, no one in the world has read this book but me. Hopefully other people. So he wrote, for the first 200 years of military heritage then, Americans depended on arts of war that contemporary professional soldiers supposedly abhorred, raising and destroying enemy villages and fields, killing enemy women and children, raiding settlements for captives, intimidating and brutalizing enemy noncombatants, and assassinating enemy leaders. These are Indians, the enemy. In the frontier wars between 1607 and 1814, Americans forged two elements, unlimited war and a regular war into their first way of war. Guinier goes on to argue that not only did this way of war continue throughout the 19th century in wars against the indigenous nations, but continued in the 20th century and currently in counterinsurgent wars against peoples in Latin America, the Caribbean and Pacific, Southeast Asia, Middle and Western Asia, and Africa. Third, deliberately inflicting on the group conditions of life calculated to bring about its physical destruction in whole or in part. Forced removal of all the indigenous nations east of the Mississippi to Indian territory during the Jackson administration was clearly a calculated policy intent on destroying these people's ties to their original homelands and knowing exactly what that meant. As well as declaring Native people who did not remove to no longer be Muscogee, Sauk, Kickapoo, Choctaw, but destroying the existence of up to half of each nation removed. Mandatory boarding schools comes under the deliberately inflicting on the group conditions of life calculated to bring about their physical destruction in whole or in part. Allotment and termination, all official government policies fall under this category of the crime of genocide. The forced removal and forced incarceration of the Navajo people resulted in the death of half their population and applies. Fourth, imposing measures intended to prevent births within the group. Well, I don't know if you know this, it was pretty well known in the 1970s, but it was famously during the Termination Act, there was another little termination taking place. The U.S. government administered Indian Health Service made the top medical priority the sterilization of indigenous women. In 1974, an independent study by one of the few Native American physicians at the time, Dr. Connie Pinkerton Urey, a Choctaw Cherokee from Oklahoma, found that one in four Native women had been sterilized without her consent. Pinkerton Urey's research indicated that the Indian Health Service had, quote, singled out full-blooded Indian women for sterilization procedures. At first denied by the Indian Health Service, 2 years later, a study by the U.S. General Accounting Office found that four of the 12 Indian Health Service regions sterilized 3,406 Native women without their permission between 1973 and 1976 in a three-year period of time. They also found that 36 women under the age of 21 had been forcibly sterilized during this period, despite a court-ordered moratorium on sterilization of women younger than 21. And I remember watching finally the press conference, because this was beginning to be, this was the height of red power when this was happening, and people were really protesting this, that it was continuing. And so the head of the health service, Indian Health Service, came on national TV and he said, "We're really sorry, but this is the cure for poverty. Poverty means too many people." That's what they were using in India at the time. The sterilization also in Brazil, that to eradicate poverty. So they did stop then, but he admitted that it was the number one priority of the Indian Health Service. Their number one health issue was to make sure Native women weren't having so many children. So fifth, forcibly transferring children of the group to another group. Various government entities, mostly municipalities, counties, and states, routinely removed Native children from their families and put them up for adoption. In the Native resistance movements of the 1960s and 1970s, the demand to stop this practice was codified in the Indian Child Welfare Act of 1978. And that act said that no Native child, wherever, in anywhere in the country, in any urban area, anywhere, but identified Native child could be adopted outside their own family or clan or simply their nation. You know, say the mother is dead and there are no relatives, then the nation itself. By that time, you know, there's certainly not going to be any adoptions out. But the legislation provided no financial resources for Native governments to establish infrastructure to retrieve children from the adoption industry, in which ghoulishly Indian babies were in high demand. After U.S. wars, it really is ghoulish, but they had these Operation Baby lists, you know, the Korean babies and the Vietnamese babies. It's people want to, it's that possession thing, but it's especially strong about Indian children. So despite these barriers to enforcement, the worst abuses, the word had gotten around, and they had been curbed in the following three decades. But on June 25th, 2013, the U.S. Supreme Court, in a 5-4 ruling drafted by Justice Samuel Alito, used provisions of the Indian Child Welfare Act to say that a child widely known as Baby Veronica did not have to live with her biological Cherokee father. The High Court's decision paved the way for Matt and Melanie Copabianca, the adopted parents, to ask the South Carolina courts, where they're from, to have the child returned to them. The court gutted the purpose and intent of the Indian Child Welfare Act, missing the concept behind it, the protection of the cultural resource and treasure that are Native children, not about protecting so-called traditional or nuclear families, the Cherokee father. It's about recognizing the prevalence of extended families and culture. So why does the Genocide Convention matter? Since it's controversial and since there's so many misinterpretations, why use it? Why not just say ethnic cleansing? Well, it's not just history that predates the 1948 Genocide Convention or the U.S. signing of it in 1988. But the history is important and needs to be widely aired, including public school texts and public service announcements, because it's linked to what is the situation right now. The doctrine of discovery is still the law of the land in the United States. From the 15th century to the 20th century, most of the non-European world was colonized under the doctrine of discovery, one of the first principles of international law that Christian European monarchies promulgated to legitimize investigating, mapping, and claiming lands belonging to peoples outside of Europe. It originated in a papal bull issued in 1455 that permitted the Portuguese monarchy to seize West Africa for slave raiding, initiating the Atlantic slave trade. Following Columbus's infamous exploratory voyage in 1492, sponsored by the king and queen of the infant Spanish state, another papal bull had extended similar permission to Spain in the Western Hemisphere. Disputes between the Portuguese and Spanish monarchies led to the papal-initiated Treaty of Tordesillas of 1494, which, besides dividing the globe equally between the two Iberian empires, clarified that only non-Christian lands fell under the doctrine of discovery. This doctrine, on which all European states and Euro-American, upon which they relied, originated in this arbitrary and unilateral establishment of the Iberian monarchy's exclusive rights under Christian canon law to take anything they wanted. But it wasn't just monarchies. It can't be said just to be a medieval relic just because it happened in the 15th century. The French Republic used, after its revolution, used this legalistic instrument for its 19th and 20th century settler colonialist projects, which continue in the Caribbean and the Pacific, as did the newly independent United States when it continued the colonization of North America begun by the British and continues to hold island colonies in the Caribbean and Pacific as well. In 1792, not long after the founding of the United States, Thomas Jefferson, who was then Secretary of State before he was president, claimed that the doctrine of discovery developed by European states was international law applicable to the new U.S. government as well. And then in 1823, the U.S. Supreme Court issued a decision in a Cherokee case, Johnson versus McIntosh, and writing for the majority, Chief Justice Marshall held that the doctrine of discovery had been an established principle of European law and English law in effect in Britain's North American colonies, and was also the law of the United States. So it's very interesting, you know, the conceit is always that the United States broke away as this little scrabble, poor little colonies, and made a complete break from Britain. But they kept, you know, they kept their international law for colonizing. So this court, John Marshall's Supreme Court, defined the exclusive property rights that a European country acquired by dint of discovery. Discovery gave title to the government, this is his language, by whose subjects or by whose authority it was made, against all other European governments, forget about the people inside it, which title might be consummated by possession. So this is like, possession means warfare to take it. So he did say, the court, and in two other cases, came up with this domestic dependent nations. But Marshall also said, in no instance is our indigenous rights disregarded, but necessarily to a considerable extent, his language, impaired. The court further held that indigenous rights to complete sovereignty as independent states were necessarily diminished. Indigenous peoples could continue to live on the land at the grace of the government, but the title resided in the discovering power, the United States. The decision concluded that Native nations were domestic dependent nations. So that is still the law. As recently as 2009, I think it was, there was another Supreme Court decision in a Cayuga Oneida case, land case, in which the doctrine of discovery and those decisions from 1820s were used to deny the Oneidas their claim. So the doctrine of discovery is so taken for granted in this settler society. It's also, in effect, here, you don't have the legislation that goes along with it, but it's assumed in the treatment of the property rights. It's rarely ever mentioned in historical or legal texts published in the Americas. United Nations Permanent Forum on Indigenous Peoples, which meets annually for 2 weeks in New York at the UN, all of those documents are available, archived on the UN, United Nations website. But few U.S. citizens are aware of the precarity of the situation of indigenous peoples in the United States. Now, I want to read just a short piece. I have a couple more minutes, and that's how long it will take. I don't know if any of you have ever heard of this place, but I think it's a good way to end, and I think it probably applies in Canada too. It's a section of the conclusion called Ghosts and Demons to Hide From. A living symbol of the genocidal history of the United States, as well as a kind of general subconscious knowledge of it, is the Winchester Mystery House. It's a tourist site in the Santa Clara Silicon Valley of Northern California, 50 miles south of San Francisco. It is billed as a ghost house, on billboards that start appearing, as far as I know, maybe in Vancouver, but certainly in Seattle, all the way down the coast, and the south from San Diego all the way up. Big signs, you know, visit, and has ghoulish kind of figures and ghosts and on the billboards. So Sarah L. Winchester, the wealthy widow of William Wirt Winchester, built the Victorian mansion to avoid and elude ghosts. That's precisely why she built the house. Although there is no record of the ghosts ever being found in her home, it could be said that perhaps Mrs. Winchester's project from 1884 to her death in 1922 was a success. She likely was very well aware of the widely publicized ghost dance in 1890, which led to the killing of Sitting Bull and the Wounded Knee Massacre. The dancers believed that the dance would bring back their dead warriors and civilians, all who were shot, died unnaturally by bullets. It makes sense that Mrs. Winchester felt the need to guard herself from the ghosts of those killed by the Winchester repeating rifle, which her late husband's father had invented and produced in 1866, with later models being even more lethal. Mrs. Winchester inherited the fortune accumulated by her husband's family, and she was the only surviving, in-law member of the family. So it all went to her, huge fortune. There was only one major purchaser of the Winchester rifle, and it was designed for that purchaser, the U.S. Department of War, which it was rightly called and still should be called. They changed it in World War II to Department of Defense. The chief reason for the War Department's purchases of the rifle in great quantities was one purpose: to kill Indians. The rifle was a technological innovation designed especially for the U.S. Army's campaigns against the Plains Indians following the Civil War. It's sort of like the M16 rifle in Vietnam, and even now the M16 was the Winchester at that time, up until World War II. The Winchester House, that they call a mystery house, amazes all who tour it. There are five floors, more or less, since they are staggered. It's hard to tell. Each room in itself appears normal, more or less. That is decorated in the late 19th century Victorian mode, with velvet couches and very uncomfortable little couches and chairs and wallpaper and, a lot of things. But there's more than meets the eye in getting from parlors to bedrooms to kitchen to closets and from floor to floor. Numerous stairways dead end, and secret trap doors hide the actual stairways. Closet doors open to walls, and pieces of furniture really doors to closets. Huge bookcases serve as entrances to adjoining rooms. Part of the house was unfinished when the widow died. She kept building on it, as she had construction workers building every day from when she started it till the day she died, from dawn to dusk, 7 days a week, adding rooms and traps until her death. Visitors trekking through the widow's home are astounded and perhaps saddened, although there's a lot of joking to crazy old lady, of course, by the evidence all around them of the fears and anguish of an obviously mentally disturbed person. Yet there is another possibility, a sense of the scaffolding that supports U.S. society, a kind of hologram in the minds of each and every person on the continent. Mrs. Winchester might have been more aware of the truth than most people, and therefore fearful of its consequences, as everyone should be. Regardless, in continuing to find or invent enemies across the globe, expand what is already the largest military force in the world, and add to an elaborate global network of 1,000 military bases, all in the name of national or global security, does not the United States today resemble Mrs. Winchester constantly trying to foil her ghosts? The guilt harbored by most is buried and expressed in other ways, including gun violence on a larger scale, regeneration through violence, as Richard Slotkin puts it. Thank you.
You were just listening to Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz on genocide and settler colonialism. She spoke at Simon Fraser University in Burnaby, British Columbia. Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz, a distinguished scholar, has been active in the international indigenous movement for many years. She's the author of many books, including An Indigenous People's History of the United States, winner of the American Book Award. This program is produced by Alternative Radio, based in Boulder, Colorado. We are an independent nonprofit in our 36th year. We're supported solely by individuals just like you. We feature voices rarely heard in the corporate media, such as Ralph Nader, Angela Davis, Chris Hedges, Vandana Shiva, and Tariq Ali. We also have a series of programs featuring Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz. To access our complete audio and book catalog, just go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, our website where we are podcasting, alternativeradio.org. To place a credit card order for copies of today's program, Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz on Genocide and Settler Colonialism, and for her book, An Indigenous People's History of the United States, just call us 1-800-444-1977. That's 1-800-444-1977. Or you can order online on our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org. Printed transcripts, PDFs, and MP3s of this program are free of charge. Special thanks to Professor Samir Gundesha and Simon Fraser University. Joe Ritchie is our general manager and editor. I'm David Barsamian. Thank you for listening. We go out with Gustav Mahler's Adagietto from his Symphony No. 5, performed by the Berlin Philharmonic.
Listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, your alternative to mainstream media. Broadcasting from Simon Fraser University at Burnaby Mountain, British Columbia.
Did you know the Simon Fraser Public Interest Research Group, aka SFPERG, has been leading social and environmental activism on campus for 40 years. SFPERG is student activism, by students, for students. Do you have a vision for a brighter future? Are you passionate about changing the world? Visit us at www.sfperg.ca. That's www.sfpirg.ca to learn more about getting involved today.
Wow.